This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, KCSB reporter Lisa Osborne speaks with Simone Ruskamp, the co-founder of Santa Barbara's Juneteenth celebration, about this year's turnout in the county.
We have over 2,000 people come to Plaza Del Mar across from the beach. I'm so proud of what we've done.
Then, my interview with Thomas Kessler and Brittany Webb from the History Center of San Luis Obispo County about recent budget cuts. Here's Brittany.
My job is ultimately to make sure that materials remain cared for and accessible. With these budget cuts, my position is actually being eliminated.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 23rd, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with the nonprofit story with Dr. Consuelo Mukes.
I have Kayla Rutland, who is the executive director of City Farm Slow, and we have Pate Detrani, the new program manager, and they're here to tell us about what City Farm Slow is and some of the wonderful updates that are happening. So welcome to the nonprofit story.
Thank you so much, Consuelo. It's great to be back.
Yeah, it is great to have you here. We have you here quite often, but you always have new things going on. Why don't you start for those who are just learning about City Farm Slow and tell us who you are and what your mission is.
We are a nonprofit urban farm, and we are empowering the next generation through sustainable agriculture and farm-based education. We're located right in the heart of San Luis Obispo. We're on 19 acres of land that we lease from the city, and of that land, we sublease out about 13 acres to our tenant farmers. And then on the remaining portion of that land, which is roughly 4 acres, we are regeneratively farming and teaching folks what that means, why it's important, and hosting a variety of youth education programs as well as community programs.
Okay, we have to break that down a little bit.
Yeah, that was a lot.
Okay, so you're starting off with people who actually have their own farms out there, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we have 6 farmers who are on our property, and they're small scale, independent, organic farmers, mm-hmm. and they're growing food for our community. You'll see their fruits and vegetables in farmers markets, in local schools. They sell direct to consumer through Harvestly. Mm-hmm. So
well, that's interesting.
Totally.
I guess they're at the farmer's market every week.
Some of our farmers are, yeah. And Kate can talk a little bit more, too, about our City Farmer Collaborative, which supports mm-hmm. our tenant farmers with sales opportunities, including our new farm stand.
Let's hear a little bit more about how farmers benefit.
So City Farm created a farmer collaborative for us and our tenant farmers to be able to kind of have a joint collaboration of all of our produce to sell to some buyers. We sell to Slow Ranch Market and to Bread Bike and a couple of other restaurants in the local area. And then we also just launched our farm stand, which started about 3 weeks ago. It's every Wednesday from 1 to 5:30, and that we provide our produce that we grow on site at City Farm, and then also our tenant farmers, they provide those produce that they sell. And so we have an opportunity for community members to come check out the farm, see where it's being grown, and then buy our produce and then also our tenant farmers' produce.
So you're getting the food from a lot of different sources from your particular farm.
Yeah, all from that 19 acres that we're stewarding. And we're really excited about that collaborative because there's so many challenges for small-scale farmers. There's land access and accessing water, and then being able to find the markets when you are that smaller size is really challenging. That's one of the barriers that we're hoping to address through that work that small-scale farmers face in our area. Mm-hmm. And it's been successful so far.
Can people come and buy directly from them at that farm, or they need to find them at the market and all?
They don't have farm stands themselves at their sites, but we have a farm stand every Wednesday that people can come by and buy produce from. Other than that, it would be through Harvestly or at the farmers markets.
Wonderful. So let's talk a bit about the idea of sustainability and regeneration, which is really central to some of your programs. Just briefly let us know what those terms mean and then what the programs are doing to make them happen.
At City Farm, we practice regenerative agriculture. Mm-hmm. And the way I like to start describing that is by saying we're going beyond organic. Our ultimate mission in farming the land is to improve the health of the soil and the land, so the ecosystem below ground and above ground. We're seeking to improve that health over time. In some other farming systems, in conventional farming, for example, we may just be sustaining the health of land over time, or in some cases degrading that land so that years later we're not able to farm it. There's a whole host of practices that fall within regenerative farming. Kate can talk pretty specifically about those because she's on site every day teaching our volunteers and interns and College Corps fellows how to do all of those things that fall within regenerative ag.
Well, let's hear about that then and how it is benefiting our community. And then we're going to talk later about how you're letting others come and learn about this too.
I usually start to talk about regenerative farming when volunteers or community members come for a tour at the farm from the ground up. Mm-hmm. There's so much going on underneath our feet in the soil. I like to describe it as a city underneath our feet of all of the soil microorganisms. One of the main pillars of our regenerative farming is being a no-till farm. So we try to disturb that soil life as little as possible. And by doing that, we just have a really strong basis to have nutrients cycled through and have nutrients at the right levels for our plants, and it kind of promotes a really healthy ecosystem overall from there. So we have the plants that we're purposely growing, like our crops, and then we also have beneficial growing areas interspersed within the growing zone, so that we're encouraging some other ecosystems that are naturally there aside from the crops that we're growing. By having the growing areas that are more natural, more of our pollinator rows, we're encouraging the natural ecosystem to coincide with our farming practices so that we can rely on the natural systems that the ecosystem already has to do things like pest control and cycle through nutrients and make sure that we can just focus on growing our crops and the soil is really feeding it. And it allows us to be organic and not have to rely on synthetic fertilizers or pesticides because we're relying on the natural ecosystems that we're promoting to do that work for us.
I mean, actually, it's wonderful. Not only are you teaching the farmers themselves as well as some of the students that come out, these types of practices.
Definitely. We like to say that we serve farmers in every stage of their life cycle. So if they're a kindergartner on the farm with us, they may be a future farmer.
Right.
And then as they grow older, we see them again in some of our programs that are geared towards older students. They may graduate and then return to us as a farming intern, which we just started our newest cohort of summer regenerative farming interns. Most of them are studying things like plant science or ecological management, and they may be studying at a nearby university and then over the summer doing a lot of their hands-on learning with us. And then beyond the college-age programs, we work with beginning farmers as well who may be renting land from us at City Farm, or they may be farming regionally and benefiting from some of our farmer networking events and farmer training events.
Well, that's fantastic in that you have the College Corps. Is that what that is?
We do have College Corps, and that's in addition to our summer programming.
Okay.
So yeah, lots of students coming over from Cal Poly, Cuesta, and able to work on the farm and really get that hands-on experience that they may be learning in the classroom, concepts from the classroom.
So what kind of concepts is that, like the climate control and everything that you have to do with climate and soil, or helping with food security for others?
They learn all the foundational skills of regenerative farming that we do at City Farm. So like Kate mentioned, it really starts underground and then we work our way up. Our philosophy around farming is healthy soils, healthy plants, healthy people. And all of our college age students and younger are learning the actual practices that go into that. They're flipping beds. They're applying compost. We're farming everything by hand. So it's pretty labor intensive. They'll spend many days in the summer pruning and trellising tomatoes and cucumbers, working with our animals, and then also working with our younger students to teach what they're learning at that more advanced level down to our younger learners.
Well, let's talk about the younger learners. Because you start with elementary school?
Yeah, elementary school. We even have some pre-K classes come out to the farm. Usually our first interaction with young kids is when they're coming out on a farm field field trip. That's offered to all the school districts in the county and actually beyond the county as well. They come out with their classrooms, a class at a time, and they're on the farm for 2 hours at a time, exploring the concepts that they're learning in their classrooms, but on the farm in a really hands-on way. They learn about pollinators, soil science, parts of a plant, and they get to investigate while they're on the farm. And we're always connecting them too with the foods that they see in the grocery store. I love when kids come out to the farm and they pull up a carrot for the first time and they're like, oh, that's how that grows. And then they're always asking us for seconds of raw veggies. Like, kindergartners eating raw beets is always amazing to me. And then they go home and tell their parents that they want to eat beets because they learned about it on the farm.
Do you go to different elementary schools and do they get to come out there? How often and how many different schools are you reaching?
This year, we reached more than 35 schools. And we don't go to the classroom, but rather the classroom comes to us because mm-hmm. we want the kids to have that experience of being on the farm. This upcoming year will be our biggest year of field trips yet. We don't know exactly yet how many classrooms we'll have joining us, but we're gearing up for our biggest year yet. There's a lot of demand for that program.
Why is this going to be your biggest year?
There's just so much demand for it. I think a lot of teachers recognize the significance of having the kids on the farm, seeing where their food comes from, mm-hmm. having that intimate experience with the land and their food. We've just seen continuous growth year after year. Mm-hmm. At the same time, some of our federal funding for that program has been decreased. So now mm-hmm. we're turning to our community for support in sponsoring classrooms to be able to visit.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because I'm sure the community is going to want to support this because we have to get our food. And as you're saying, the food security is, you know, tentative now these days. So you're doing a wonderful thing for that. Kate, how is it that you're connecting with all of this with your programs?
I started at City Farm working with our community volunteers through an AmeriCorps position. And now that that is ending or has ended, I'm transitioning kind of into a more overarching programs role at City Farm. So I work with community volunteers still. I also work with some of our regenerative farming interns, teaching farming to adult community members. Mm-hmm. And then also a little bit more behind the scenes, working on how we can get more people on the farm, get more people experiencing different things, whether it's a work day or an educational tour or family cooking night, just kind of thinking about how we can get more people on the site, seeing where their food's growing.
Can you tell us about one of your programs, like your family cooking night? What's that like? And how do you see the community responding?
Yeah, so we just did our first pilot event of our family cooking night in preparation for launching a series of it. We had families of K through 12 students. The students had been at the farm for a field trip. Some of them had heard of the farm through social media and word of mouth. And the families came to the farm and they harvested vegetables. They learned a little bit about our regenerative farming practices, harvested the vegetables themselves, and then we cooked a meal together. We made flatbread pizzas and kids were putting kale and little bits of broccoli on their pizzas, and we ate rainbow rolls. We heard some parents say it was the only time they had seen their kid eat a raw vegetable, and they're like handfulling a raw cabbage and beets and stuff.
Wow. That sounds incredible. And I mean, this might be the first time these kids have actually had these green vegetables, and certainly right out of the ground, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How can people participate in that? Does it come from one of the schools, or do you announce that and people can be a part of that?
We'll be launching a series of the Family Cook Nights probably starting this fall, and folks will be able to register for that through the City of SLO Parks and Rec website and then also through City Farm channels. So you can always find our upcoming events on our website, which is cityfarmslo.org, on our Instagram as well, which is cityfarmslo.
And if you're just joining in, this is The Nonprofit Story. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mukes, the host, and we're listening to Kayla Rutland, who is the executive director of City Farm SLO, as well as Kate Detrani. She is the new program manager over there at City Farm SLO, and learning about those programs and all the excitement of them. I want to ask you a little bit about your therapeutic horticultural program.
That is the program that's nearest and dearest to my heart. We are able to work with students from middle school all the way into early adulthood, and we partner with school districts in their special day classes. So much like our field trip program, we have a classroom of students visit the farm at a time. But what I love about that program is classrooms come every week. Mm-hmm. So we get to build relationships with the students who are coming. And because we serve middle school through post high school, we will see the same students for year after year after year. And some of the kids in that program have been coming for 8+ years now. And it's really an honor to watch how much they grow and transform on the farm. A lot of kids, when they come out, are really afraid of our animals, for example. And with time doing relatively repetitive tasks on the farm led by our farm instructors, they gain a lot of confidence. They become a lot more comfortable working with our animals. They try a lot of new foods. They become more comfortable working with one another, moving around on the farm. So it's been such a joy to see how transformative those programs can be. We hear the same thing from the teachers who come out with their students as well. They're kind of amazed at the side of their students that they get to see when they're in this outdoor learning environment and really challenged to do more and more each time they visit.
Yeah. Kate, just bouncing off of that, are there new programs that are going to be coming up to help with the students and the parents and the community getting involved?
The family cooking night is really the one that we're hoping is going to get a lot more families on the farm.
That sounds exciting.
Yeah.
We also have a relatively new community farm tour program, which welcomes folks out to the farm on the first Saturday of each month. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, there's so many ways for people to come to the farm. We have a really robust volunteer program that Kate has led. So every Saturday now, we host volunteers on the farm. And then every Tuesday and Thursday as well, folks are invited to come out and help us with harvest.
That's great.
Yeah. And that's a pretty technical volunteer position. So our harvest volunteers learn a lot of the intricacies of our regenerative farming practices and then also learn a lot about our post-harvest process and distribution.
That's fantastic that everybody can take part like this. Now, do you have a special program for students who may have disabilities or other things that are going on with them that they can come out to the farm and you help them out also?
Our therapeutic horticulture program is catered specifically for students with disabilities. Yeah, so that operates through the school year in partnership with school districts where classrooms come out. And we just now are extending that over the summer as well. We have a corporate sponsor who's partnered with us to be able to offer that service through the summer as well. And then we do have a program that I'm really excited about. It's our youth empowerment program, and that's targeted towards at-risk teens. But it's open to anyone who's 14 to 17 years old and interested in both learning about farming, but really what that program is doing is building career and college readiness skills. So when students are on the farm with us, they're building resumes, they're writing SMART goals, they're practicing interviewing, they're exploring different careers in agriculture and visiting Cal Poly. They also do 90 minutes of farm work with us each day, which provides this really great structure and framework for them to get to know each other, feel comfortable building relationships with our adult mentors on the farm, and then also their peers. And that program was launched in 2021 and is on its 13th cohort right now. And over the course of the summer, we'll see our 16th cohort.
That's amazing.
Come through. Yeah.
So when you're saying at-risk kids, where do they come from or how do you get them?
We do a lot of outreach through school districts and then all the other ways that we reach folks in this community as well. And we noticed in the past that transportation could be a barrier for students who may not be living in SLO and may be living in lower income areas in other parts of the county. And so a few years ago, we introduced another part of that program that provides transportation for students from North County, South County, coastal areas of the county to ensure that everyone who could benefit from that program is able to come to the farm and take part in it.
So a lot of people in the community are helping out or getting together to come and make sure that this is going to be successful, correct?
Yeah, we definitely benefit from a lot of community support. We're fortunate for that. And like I mentioned before, it's also a challenging time for nonprofits. A lot of federal funding has been cut back. So we're turning to our community more than ever these days and really do need the support of folks who are local and value the work that we're doing to empower youth through farming.
And how can people know how to support you? Can they do that through your website?
For sure. So cityfarmslo.org. and you can learn all the information about us there and all of our upcoming events. There's also a donation page there, so it's really easy to make a one-time donation. Or we also have a Friends of the Farm membership program, which allows folks to sign up to become sustaining members, so making a gift every month. That's particularly helpful for us because it allows us to plan ahead. We know what to expect in the dollar amount, and that really allows us to expand our programs and bring more at-risk kids to the farm year after year.
I want to ask both of you something as we get towards the end here. When you dream about the future of all of this and you see what's happening in the world and with our food insecurities and all of the other situations, what are some of the next chapter things that you might like to see City Farm SLO present to this community?
One of my personal missions doing this work is to help a small local food system thrive. Ideally, everyone in our community would be purchasing our food from a local farmer that's also in our community, and that builds resilience in many different ways. On a smaller scale, we can use more climate-friendly and more responsible farming practices. We, as consumers, aren't always paying the real cost of food. So we might really enjoy getting a discount at the big box store and paying a lower price for our groceries. But there's a cost that's downstream from that if there's not responsible practices being used to grow those foods. So in doing this work, I hope that City Farm can support a local food system that's healthy and thriving, and where everyone in our community is healthy and thriving as a result of that. And I think the way to do that is to work with our next generation to help them, inspire them to be the environmentalists of the future, the sustainable farmers, and then to also work with our current farmers and our local food system to ensure that local farmers and small-scale farmers can be successful.
That's wonderful. So what are some of the things that you're seeing for the future, and how is this going to make a difference in a community, especially at this time in our lives?
There's a lot of challenges facing the next generation, not just of farmers, but just in general. We at City Farm are very fiercely committed to sustainable environmental practices, and I hope that every student who comes out to the farm takes something away about how to promote sustainability in their own life. And some of them hopefully will become the farmers of our future.
So others, we can come out there. Somebody just wants to come from the area and say, we want to have a tour, we want to find out about the farm, maybe purchase some of the goods that you have.
Yeah, definitely. We have the community farm tours, like Kayla mentioned, the first Saturday of every month. So if you're in town on one of those Saturdays, definitely come by. You can sign up on our website for those. And then we also host private tours. If you want to sign up for a tour for a group or family outside of those Saturdays, you can sign up on our website as well for that. And then if you want to get your hands dirty when you come to the farm, you can come to a volunteer day, which is every Saturday, barring scheduling conflicts, from 9 to noon.
Are there any other things that you want to add and let us know about this? And also, I didn't realize you had as many animals. What kind of animals do you have out there?
We have sheep and chickens. They're a lot of fun. They're mostly a teaching tool.
Good.
They contribute to our healthy pastures and grazelands. But yeah, it's a great way to get kids excited about being on the farm. Our programs are growing all the time. We'll be offering a farm camp at the end of this summer for kids locally to sign up for. That will be available through the City of SLO Parks and Rec website. We've felt really successful in the programs that we've landed on the farm that are providing a lot of benefits to the folks who come out. So this year, our focus is to grow each and every one of those programs and do more of the good work that we've been doing.
Wonderful. I want to thank you so much. We've been listening to Kayla Rutland, who is the executive director, and Kate Diatrani, who is the program manager of City Farm SLO. I hope you'll go to their website and support them. This has been the Nonprofit Story. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Next, June 19th is celebrated across the country as Juneteenth National Independence Day. KCSB reporter
Lisa Osborne talks with Simone Ruskam about the experience of celebrating it in Santa Barbara County and about a new survey that seeks data on the state of the Black community in the county.
Simone Ruskamp grew up attending Juneteenth celebrations in her hometown of Oakland.
There is this beautiful Juneteenth celebration in Oakland that is an entire weekend, so it's 2 days, but it's block after block after block with all different types of Black creatives, Black artists, several different stages, and there's always like special time built in for Father's Day because, you know, it typically overlaps with that same weekend.
But when she came to UC Santa Barbara as a student, she said she had to drive out of town to connect with Juneteenth celebrations.
In Santa Barbara, I certainly was looking for community. I won't speak for every student at UCSB, but in my experience as a dark-skinned Black student, it was so easy to feel isolated. And I will even go as far as to say, I think some of that is intentional, right? There's very few Black students on that campus. It takes a lot of effort to find and be a part of Black community. And so while I was at UCSB, and even once I graduated, I would actually drive out to Ventura or Oxnard to join Juneteenth celebrations because it was something, again, that was a part of just my family's culture.
Simone explains how Santa Barbara's Juneteenth celebration came to be in 2018 with the help from her co-founders, Jordan Killebrew and Kiani Dree.
That first celebration, Chiani, Jordan, and I, and Jordan's husband, York, we cooked all of the food ourselves.
Wow.
And we made a flyer.
Sojourner Kincaid Roll, former county poet laureate, supported Simone's vision of starting a Juneteenth celebration in Santa Barbara.
I just was so blessed to know and have been loved by her because she didn't really even know us. If I think about just like the love that she already had for us when we reached out to her and we're like, okay, Ms. Sojourner, I know you don't know us, but you want to do this Juneteenth celebration. She was there for the first one. She was so supportive, so loving. She came and actually when she introduced herself to me, she said, you know, I'm a community poet. And I didn't really know what that meant. But then she came to Juneteenth and she actually led everybody there. It was like 100-150 people, which surprised us because again, it was three of us who cooked everything at home. She asked the community to help her write a poem about Juneteenth all together. So people were able to offer different lines, different refrains about like what freedom looks like to them. And then she kind of wove it all together. It was this beautiful experience. And again, if I think about what it means to be Black and in community and certainly to have elders who lovingly claim you, it was very much that.
This year's Juneteenth Santa Barbara celebration took place last Saturday, and the celebration has grown.
This year, we have over 2,000 people come to Plaza del Mar across from the beach. It has been so much work, a huge journey, but I'm so proud of what we've done. I will say, I think our second or third year, we started including a Black artisan market. And so that's where Black creatives, of course, can share, sell many different things. So like paintings, t-shirts, candles, wellness products, right? We also have community organizations. And I will say in total, both of those together was over 40 different folks tabling. I think what's really unique about Juneteenth is there are so many festivals in Santa Barbara, which claim to be free, but everything is a price. So like you want to go with your family, but then you have to pay for face painting. You have to pay for a meal. Each of these things adds up and it becomes really expensive. And so we have tried to keep that even though now we're in our eighth year. So for example, we try to provide a certain amount of free meals because we don't want families to feel like, oh, I can't participate. Or like, this is a day for Black liberation, but can I afford it? Right? We didn't want that. Another thing was that we wanted Black vendors who may not be able to get into other markets because of really high vendor fees. We don't charge anybody to vend. We even help people by providing the rentals, so like the tent and the table and the chairs. We do all of that because we know that there are so many intentional ways that Black folks are prevented from creating community with each other or even supporting one another's gifts and talents. And something that I'm so proud we've continued with.
Is the community supporting you in helping to continue to fund Juneteenth and the activities that you're doing?
Yes, in a mix of ways. So certainly folks can donate at our website. It also has a digital archive of Black history there, which is awesome. But that is JuneteenthSB.org. We
We also do get some funding from the city of Santa Barbara, the city of Goleta, and the county of Santa Barbara. Now, I'll be very honest and say that financial support did not happen until 2020. And that happened in the midst of myself and Crystal, especially from Healing Justice, leading several direct actions, putting our bodies further at risk, and then asking for community to call into city council meetings, county board of supervisors meetings, and demanding investment in liberation holidays. And we were very specific with that wording because even now, the city provides significantly more money to things like fiestas, which is a whole other conversation. But if you hear me say very clearly, right, Juneteenth is a Black liberation holiday, folks can figure out what it is that fiesta celebrates, right?
Good for you for speaking up and seizing the moment, right? And you're also doing a survey of the state of the Black community in Santa Barbara County. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. So often Black people are erased from our own experiences, and that is the same even in Santa Barbara. And so Jordan and I and Chiani worked quite hard in partnership with UCSB and Ms. Kim to put together a first of its kind survey specifically around Black folks, Black community. And I should say, we know that Black community, Black families in Santa Barbara can look like non-Black folks raising Black children. It can look like, you know, interracial families or couples. We want to include all of that just to be able to have a better understanding of what it is that Black people need. What are some of the challenges that we're facing in Santa Barbara? And it's really important that we say in Santa Barbara County, because the experience of Blackness is different all across the country, but even within our own state. And so this is the first time that something has been researched in this way, and we certainly need more responses. I will also say that the NAACP North County has helped us put together some incentives for the survey. So please fill out the survey. It is on our website, which again is JuneteenthSB.org. And we would love to hear what you are seeing and what you're experiencing as a Black person in Santa Barbara. And again, even if you are a non-Black caregiver, partner, or spouse of somebody who is Black, you also can complete it on their behalf. We just want to make sure we're getting the information so that we're not losing insights from community members. We also hope that it'll help us inform different work that nonprofits are doing, because oftentimes we see nonprofits almost decide on their own what it is that they think Black people need or what they think the universal experience of Black people in Santa Barbara is without being connected in relationships or data. And this will allow us to speak together about, you know, what we've been seeing.
For KCSB News, I'm Lisa Osborne.
This is KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Up next, the History Center of San Luis Obispo County lost a third of its funding from the county just this month. Here, Executive Director Thomas Kessler and Collections Manager Brittany Webb talk about how these cuts will impact the operations of the History Center and its extensive collection that holds historical material from all over the county. Welcome, Thomas and Brittany.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thomas, can you share with us the history of the History Center?
Yeah. The History Center actually has its foundations in the Dalladay Gardens. The short version of that story is Pierre Dalladay moved here in the 1850s. He and his wife, Ascension Concepcion Salazar, went on to have 9 children. Fast forward 100 years, we're in the 1950s. Paul Dalladay is caught shoplifting food from the grocery store. The grocery store owner calls a local attorney, Peter Andre of Andre Morris and Buttery. And to Peter Andre's eternal credit, he says, let him take what he needs and let me know what I owe you. Peter started looking into it and discovered that Paul is destitute. He's about to lose the home to tax foreclosure, and he has nothing. And so Peter says, no, that's not going to happen. He creates a nonprofit to take ownership of the Dalladay Adobe and Gardens. Paul is given a life annuity. He spends the rest of his life in his family home. He always had food in the pantry. He always had rides to the doctor. And when he passed peacefully at home in 1958, this nonprofit that would become the History Center took ownership over the gardens, and we've owned them ever since. This was also right around the time of the centennial of the city of San Luis Obispo, and so local interest in our local history was at a high, and this nonprofit vehicle was the perfect avenue for starting to collect stories, images, objects of our local past. The Dalla de Adobe being our largest single item, but we have tens of thousands of objects, photographs, stories, documents, everything relating to remembering and promoting the understanding and appreciation of local history.
So we spoke a few days ago, and you told me that the History Center has not been included in SLO County's budget for this year. Is that correct? And can you talk about what has happened and what it means for the future of the History Center?
As a history organization, obviously I need to start the story a little further back. In the early days, the person who held my position was a county employee. They were the county historian who then worked with this nonprofit, which at the time was called the Historical Society. And eventually it was decided that the person running the Historical Society should be a direct employee of this 501c3 corporation. And so in 1980, the county made an agreement that rather than stopping support, they would pay to have a full-time employee. The county made a 20-year agreement, 1980 to 2000, to provide funding to the History Center for us to have professional staff, a museum, and a collection. The initial 20-year agreement expired in 2000. It was renewed for another 20 years. Unfortunately, 2020 was right in the middle of the whole COVID mess, and so that agreement did end up being ended a little early, but ever since then, we have had 1 year at a time renewals of the agreement with the county. And unfortunately, this year, the county just has a hole to fill that involved a lot of really difficult decisions on their part. And unfortunately, we were not included in that funding moving forward. And unfortunately, that is about a third of our budget. So it's going to have a pretty major impact on our capacity to provide some of the services that we have been providing.
And when was it that it was that you found out that you were not included? Was it that they notified you before they did that, or was it after the budget was passed?
So we knew it. They had a big hole to fill. Last year, they did an across-the-board 3% cut. And so rather than $110,000, we received $104,000. We knew there was a good likelihood of an even larger cut. They never did reach out to us. The staff recommended budget was released a few weeks ago, and it's a large 1,000-plus page document. If you do a Control-F word search for History Center, we landed on two sentences that they were recommending eliminating the funding for the History Center and ending the subvention agreement.
So this is pretty recent. This is like 2 weeks ago that you found out that History Center has not been included.
Correct.
Okay.
And so I did end up meeting with three of the supervisors. I know it was not an easy decision on their part. I know that it doesn't mean that they don't support history. I know, for example, Transitions Mental Health is facing a much larger cut than we are in terms of dollar amount. I know that there are health clinics in Paso Robles that will be closing. I know it's going to be hard times in this county, but I also think that history needs to be a through line and needs to be maintained. If we lose a story, it's never coming back. And so maintaining that kind of constant attention to and focus on history is really important.
Brittany, you are the collections manager at the History Center. Can you tell us what your job entails, and also how will this financial crunch affect your work specifically?
So my job as the collections manager is the care and oversight of the collection. That means ensuring items decay as absolutely slowly as possible because there's no way to permanently stop decay. That means ensuring access. And that means making sure that the collection is organized in such a way that we can always find what we are looking for to the best of our ability. It sounds simple, but it's actually really complicated because there's a lot of factors you have to, especially when it comes to care, take into account everything from climate controls to what happens to plastics as they decay, and are they going to cause other things to decay faster? Are they going to potentially catch fire if they get too hot? And yes, that is a problem with older plastics. So my job is ultimately to make sure that materials remain cared for and accessible. And with these budget cuts, my position is actually being eliminated. So we are basically going to be closing up the largest chunk of the collection, and it will not be accessible again until a new collections manager can come in, because the space in and of itself is too complicated for anybody other than somebody trained to handle. I mean, the space is bigger than our main museum, probably.
What space is this year that you're talking about?
This is our off-site storage. So anything that is on-site at the museum, we're trying to arrange it so that there will be people staffing the research room, so that will still be available. But the bulk of our material, especially our primary source material, is off-site. And this off-site storage space is basically going to just be closed down. It's too big for volunteers to try to take on or handle. I mean, before I got here, it seems to have been kind of ignored for about 20 years, roughly. I was only able to do it because my predecessor had already tackled a number of other major problems that were more important to deal with before the warehouse access issues. We have space set up for researchers to use, which is something that was not there when I got here. The space is accessible through all the aisles. It's no longer a safety risk in the case of an earthquake, which it pretty much was when I first got there. It's such a delicate environment that we can't just let anybody go in and try to navigate the space, especially because it could easily result in all of my hard work going down the drain.
There's an enormous amount of science, and this is not something that an average person off of the street could walk in and figure out.
Just a follow-up question for Brittany. How many artifacts are we talking about in the off-site storage? And if you are not here, like, what happens to them?
So if I'm not here, we padlock the door and everything stays in stasis exactly as it is until a new collections manager can come in. Nobody in or out. The only request I've made is that someone make sure the building's roof is not leaking and that it's not getting excessively hot in the summers.
And how many artifacts are there that are at the risk of basically facing degradation?
A warehouse probably has half of our collection in it easily, probably more than that.
All of Slo County's history.
I estimate we have about 120,000 artifacts in total. That's based on the data I've managed to compile. I mean, all of our glass plate negatives are out there. Those are particularly delicate, and we have to be very careful with those. We've got all the papers related to that we've received. Let me emphasize that we've received that are related to, like, the construction of Hearst Castle. Those are all out there. All of the ledgers from the county tax assessment and the associated plat maps, individual assessment books like street widenings in San Luis Obispo, the only that I am aware of surviving treasurer's book for the county starting in 1848, and the first 3 years of it are in Spanish. The jail registries, the general hospital patient registry books, the old ones, not anything current. These are from like the 30s. We have the orphanage records from the county. So that was...
What's orphanage?
So orphanage would have been any orphan in the county that was living here that was receiving aid from the state. So those are their records. Names of the children, who their parents were, if it was known, who they were staying with, some medical information. Those things are all out there. All of our framed artwork, framed photographs, and then basically all of our objects, so things that aren't documents or photographs, like furniture, our old media stuff, all of our reel-to-reel oral histories are out there, along with the player we have for that. So all of that information, all of that material is basically just going to be locked up.
What is your main concern with the storage space being padlocked? Like, what will happen to the artifacts?
My main concern is that without oversight, something's going to happen that we're not going to know about until it's 5 years after it started and it's going to be a problem. We had a massive rodent infestation in one of our other storage places, and a lot of materials had to be thrown away because they were damaged or destroyed by rodents, and that could be a concern with this particular warehouse. I've not seen evidence of rodent activity in the warehouse, you know, but that doesn't mean it couldn't be a problem further down the line. My biggest concerns are temperature and humidity, because temperature is the one factor that is potentially the most detrimental, especially for some of the more sensitive materials we have out there. And we just don't have the space to move those materials onto the main site either. So it's not like moving them is even really an option. Don't have anything super sophisticated. I have a thermometer, but I at least monitor the temperatures in there and keep an eye on what's happening to make sure it's not getting too hot. The temperature is not spiking more than 20 degrees, because that can cause film especially to warp. We have movie film out in that warehouse. And then if the humidity gets too high and it gets hot, then all of those ledgers could potentially rot out. If there's anything that had mold or mildew on it from a previous exposure too, that can reactivate. A lot of people don't know that about mold and mildew. That stuff can be activated again if it's exposed to water. It dies, but it doesn't really die. It just sort of goes dormant. It's why you have to use bleach to physically remove it from an object if you can, or other cleaning methods. You can't use bleach on paper, so that's why I specify other cleaning methods. But that's a concern, too. If there's any sort of mold or mildew that's ever been on these objects, if we get a really humid summer, then we could have a massive mold or mildew outbreak.
If you're just joining us, I'm Hair Ali, speaking with Brittany Webb, Collections Manager, and Thomas Kessler, Executive Director, both at the History Center of San Luis Obispo County. So this is pretty serious then. We are basically set to lose our county's rich history if we lose you, Brittany, as the Collections Manager. But moving on to my next question. Can both of you talk about how you're navigating this challenge? Thomas, let's start with you.
Yeah, it's definitely been a struggle. Basically, if we lose the collection, there's no getting it back. And even losing that doesn't mean having it end up in dumpsters. Even if we said, well, what if Cal Poly takes some and the county takes some and the other historical societies in the county take some? A, that's not a great idea. B, if that happens, there's no point in the museum continuing to exist. If we lose our collection, it's never coming back, and there's really no reason to continue as a historical society without having a collection. I've spent a lot of time looking at insurance coverage and things like that, and insuring a historic collection is really difficult, because if your house burns down, and that's a tragedy, and hopefully nobody is injured, but all of your stuff can be rebought with money. If we lose the original portrait of the Dana family, of Dana Adobe fame, one of the main early families in our county's history, that's never coming back. We can't replace that. We can't put it to the side, forget about it for a year or two, and then come back with a different budget.
You mentioned something, which is that, you know, what if we were to give the collection to Cal Poly or Cuesta College? How is that not a good option?
Well, they don't really have the space for it.
Well,
yeah.
I was going to add a little bit to what Thomas is saying. And in Cal Poly Special Collections, they're amazing people. There is a reason, though, that there are two different degrees out there for the kind of work I do. And one is the master's in library sciences, and one is the master's in museum science. And the big difference between the two is that library sciences focuses on paper, photographs, and paper-based preservation of those types of materials. Museum science is everything, from dinosaur bones to antique crystal. I mean, it kind of covers the whole spectrum of everything you could potentially have to worry about. Just because somebody has a library sciences background or they work in a library science or an archive, that doesn't necessarily mean they're equipped to care for museum materials. And I know that Cal Poly has some physical artifacts because we borrowed objects from them. But our collection is huge. Mm-hmm. And yes, theoretically redistributing some aspects of our collection could be relatively easy, but it still bears the question of then what happens to county-related materials. It's nice to be able to say, oh, well, we could give everything related to the five cities to South County, or we could give everything related to Paso to Paso, but what then do you do with the stuff that's county-wide? And the other thing is that we have a research space. We have accessibility. Furthermore, just because we give these items to these other institutions, that doesn't mean that, A, these institutions have the ability to care for them, because we have a huge collection. And some of the smaller institutions can't necessarily suddenly have 15 or 20,000 photographs and documents dumped on them. They don't necessarily have the volunteer power or any sort of staff whatsoever, or even the space to keep that kind of material. And you can't just say, oh, well, we'll digitize it and throw away the original, because if you do something like that and then you have a computer crash, your digitized format decays, what have you, it's gone. And museums had that happen.
So, Thomas, when you say we're thinking of closing down the History Center altogether, is that what you were saying? Can I just clarify that?
No, I do think we're going to be able to continue with a lot of our public-facing things, a lot of our events, a lot of our speeches. The museum will continue. The gardens will continue. But that isn't the biggest component of who we are and what we do. A lot of what we do isn't as visible to the public. So looking more at the research components, we get people who are writing a book and they want to know about what would have been realistic at the time. We get people who want to know about their ancestors who may well have been on the orphan list or may well have been on the jail list. And that accessibility, that possibility is what's going away.
And the offsite warehouse.
We're not going to be inviting people out there. If somebody has a question that could be answered by something in that warehouse, we are not going to be able to answer that question.
And so that's what shutting down looks like.
Yes, we are much like the mold spores, hoping to go dormant in that capacity to a certain extent. We're not going away. We're going to continue to fundraise to the best of our abilities. If we can find grant funding, if we can find sponsors, we hope this is a temporary thing, but we have no way of guaranteeing that at this point.
How can people support the History Center of San Luis Obispo County?
Absolutely. We have our big fundraising gala coming up on September 12th and 13th. You can visit the museum and learn a little bit more about where our county has been, where we're going, what we're doing. So unfortunately, we will no longer be, for the time being, accepting new item donations. I just yesterday got a phone call from a descendant of some of the more prominent families of our Chinatown past saying, I found another photo album that I'd like to give you guys. And I had to say, I'm very sorry, but we're not going to be able to accept it at this time. Come and visit us. Walk through the Dalladay Gardens. Our website is historycenterslo.org. You can make a donation. You can become a member of the Historical Society. You can buy a ticket to an upcoming event.
And can you share with us an estimate of the fiscal shortage that you're looking to cover?
So we're not a big organization. We were anticipating a little over $100,000 from the county. So there's that is the size of the hole. And unfortunately, when we let go of Brittany, we're also letting go of our weekend managers. We think we can scrape together about $65,000, $70,000 in savings, but that's another $35,000 to $40,000 that we still have as an open hole.
I've had such a positive experience being a volunteer at the History Center. And for the brief time that I was there, I learned so much about the history of the county. So can each of you talk about an exhibit, current or past, that has resonated with you or that was special to you in some way? Brittany, let's start with you.
I would say probably Wild West. That was the only exhibit here that I did. One of the things I enjoyed about it was the fact that instead of going back and reading the secondary sources that love to basically sit there and say, oh, the Americans came in and they made everything neat and organized and all of that, I threw that out the window and said, what was really going on? Because that's not an accurate representation whatsoever of the post-Mexican-American colonial period. So I was really looking at it as what was shifting, what was happening, how was this culture clash between the Spanish-Mexican culture that was here and the American culture that was coming in actually playing out. And it was fascinating to learn about. It was kind of eye-opening, and I actually had a couple of people even ask me, oh, where can I go read about this? And I had to unfortunately tell them, well, you can't, because this is compiled from primary sources.
And Thomas?
I really appreciate one of the exhibits we have up right now. It's called A Dream Interrupted. So we collaborated with a group of Cal Poly students and Professor Terry Jones of the archaeology department. He led an archaeological dig with these students on the Pecho Coast on what had been the farmstead of a Japanese-American family. And so they did this in collaboration with the descendants of this family. This was a family who was taken away to internment camps during World War II, as happened to all Japanese Americans in California. But there are still memories of this idyllic life. They lived on this beautiful stretch of the San Luis Obispo County coast. And so it's kind of a mix of archaeology and local history and national history in the way that it has impacted us here locally. We had a phenomenal opening event where something in the neighborhood of 45 to 50 descendants of this one family attended. Several of them had been out to the dig site while they were doing the dig. It was just a really meaningful way of remembering and celebrating what wasn't a thoroughly happy story based on the way it ended, but it really didn't end there because the family is still here, is still around, even if they did have this taken away from them.
Is there anything else that either of you would like to add?
Please do come and visit us. I think when you bring a picnic lunch and sit in the Dalladay Gardens on a Saturday afternoon, you'll understand a bit of the depth of the past. It can be so easy to think that we're here and we're what matters. And of course, the present matters and the future matters, but the past is what the future is built on. Where we are today is a direct result of decisions made by people who came before us. And if we don't understand those decisions, we lose the agency to make any changes. It's not a coincidence that the parking garage is on Palm Street and not a couple of blocks over, because that was the Chinatown. And it was much easier to take over the Chinatown and build a parking garage on top of that, as opposed to somebody else's neighborhood.
Brittany, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
I would just say that, you know, if we elect not to learn our own history, then we're going to make the same mistakes our ancestors did over and over again. And they made those mistakes once. We don't need to make them again. We just have to learn from their mistakes and understand why those were mistakes in the first place.
A saying that I really like is the forgetting of the history of marginalized people is both a cause and an effect of their marginalization. And so unless we make an effort to see the whole story, then we're just going to continue with the same biases that we have now.
Thank you so much, both of you, Thomas and Brittany, for joining me today on Issues and Ideas.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That was Thomas Kessler, Executive Director at the History Center of San Luis Obispo County, and Brittany Webb, who is the Collections Manager at the History Center, talking about how recent budget cuts have impacted their operations. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.